Hello there. My name is Stephen Rumford and I am the host of the Life and Death podcast, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. This is a series in which we have honest conversations about life, death, bereavement and so much more. I've worked in palliative care for more than 20 years and in this series I sit down with a host of different people to discuss their experiences of death, dying and bereavement in order to get to a deeper understanding of what life and death means for them. After the success of the first and second series, as well as a Christmas special last year, we're delighted to be back with our third series. In this episode, I'm joined by Seamus Omani, a recently retired consultant gastroenterologist who worked most recently at Cork University Hospital in Ireland, as well as at NHS hospitals in England. Seamus has established himself as a well-regarded commentator on modern medicine and healthcare systems, and has written extensively about our expectations around life, death, disease, and the daily experience he often had with patients in hospital. He's covered these areas in his three books, The Way We Die Now, Can Medicine Be Cured? And The Ministry of Bodies, Life and Death in a Modern Hospital. This last book, The Ministry of Bodies, is a look at a year in the life, if you like, of a busy hospital. Just a few months into that year, as the pandemic unfolded, Seamus made the decision to retire from practice. And I'm delighted to be joined by him today. So thank you very much, Seamus, for joining us. How's retirement?
Well, Stephen, I don't see myself as retired because I'm just doing something different. I see myself as somebody who is doing other things, and those other things include writing, having more time to do that. I've worked as a vaccinator in the Irish COVID vaccine program. I do some work for the Irish Medical Council. I do journalism. I do speaking. So I don't see myself as retired. I'm just doing different things.
Different activities.
Yeah, different things. I mean, I had become very fatigued and weary of hospital work. I only realised how tired I was when I stopped. So I left just a few weeks before COVID arrived on these shores. And I think in retrospect, that was a good decision and good timing.
In terms of the interview today, I mentioned the three books, although I want to say the book How We Die Now is up there in my library of, I've probably got a disproportionate amount of books on death and dying, and yours is certainly up there. It's an extraordinary encyclopedic look at death and dying in contemporary life. It covers many, many subjects, the book. I'm going to get you to say a little bit about it, but I did want to say a few things by way of thanks, actually, because I do think it's a really vital piece of work, actually. And it is extraordinarily clear-eyed. There is a, there is a criticality there, and there is a bravery of your, the steadiness of your gaze that you look at these things. So thank you very much for it. It's really affected me, and I've suggested it to lots of people subsequently. So I'm glad to hear you're writing more. I wonder if you could say a little bit about the genesis of that book. What was it that prompted you to do that?
First of all, thank you for those very nice comments about the book. It's good to get that kind of feedback, and I'm glad you enjoyed it and found it useful. I didn't set out to write a book. The genesis began about 10 years ago when I had coffee with a colleague of mine, an intensivist in the hospital where I was based, and we had both dealt with two families who could not accept that their respective loved ones, as the phrase goes, who had both been in hospital for many months, most of 2012, they could not accept that death was going to be the inevitable conclusion in both cases. And there was a prolonged conflict between these families and the hospital. And the doctors and nurses were at the sharp end of this conflict. And we sat down and had coffee. We'd both been involved with these patients and their families. And at the end of our chat and cup of coffee, he asked me, would I talk about the experience of death and dying in acute hospitals to a conference of intensive care doctors. This is a very famous conference. It's held in Dingle every year. And I was scheduled as the last talker on Saturday morning, at which time most of them had flown back to London or wherever in the UK, and the few remaining were hungover, not listening, you know. So I spoke to sort of a scattering of people in a large hotel ballroom for three quarters of an hour on death and dying. And at the end of it, I thought to myself, you know, this is something that I want to communicate with a bigger audience about, because I put a lot of thought into this talk and I felt very deeply and passionately about. So I said, okay, there weren't too many people listening to this talk, but you know, maybe I should go off and write, I don't know, an article for a journal or something. And as I sat down to write this, it dawned on me, no, this is way too important for some medical journal that most doctors, let alone lay people, will never read. And I thought, no, I want to reach a bigger, wider general audience. And it occurred to me as I started writing that this would have to be a book and it would have to be for a general audience. Nobody seemed to have written about what goes on in acute hospitals where, if I can use that awful phrase, most of the action with death and dying takes place. And I felt that there was nothing out there about what goes on in acute hospitals, and what was going on was not very edifying. And that's why I wanted to write about it. And that is the genesis of how it came about.
In the book, you look at the reality of dying in acute hospitals, as you say, which is where the vast majority of people, probably in the developed world, I suspect, die within. And you look at various factors that have come about both to create that situation, but also you talk about, you don't necessarily say this word, but it's almost like we've become even more frightened of death. I suspect we've always had a fear of death. I suspect there is something, you know, survival based as to why we do, you know, avoid it and avoid situations that might bring it about. But I get the sense there is greater resistance to talking about it in particular. I remember I used to do these little sessions in London at the hospital at St. Joseph's, at the hospice. It was a kind of Trojan horse to generally have discussions with people who have been diagnosed with terminal, to have discussions about death and dying. And I started it by saying, you know, there's still the two big taboos in our society that we just don't talk about, and that's sex and death. And there's a little old lady in the group who said, well, you speak for yourself, love. That's all we talk about in the nursing home. But by and large, you get the sense from your book, and also just you get the sense just talking to people, that in a way, death is more removed now than ever before from our general lives. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about the factors that you might consider have brought this about. Why are we so separate from this reality?
I suppose the main thing that changed over the last 50 years or more is that death and dying moved from communities and families into institutions and professions. You know, my grandparents' generation, most of them would have died at home. Medicine had, you know, relatively little to offer until fairly recently. So one of the themes of my second book was that there was this golden age in medicine where there was this accelerated progress over a 50-year period from roughly the mid-30s to the mid-80s, you know, where all of these innovations like antibiotics, treatment for tuberculosis, immunization, and so on and so on and so on, all of the things that we take for granted came in, and there was this huge expectation that this progress would continue indefinitely. And one of the effects of this rapid period of technological progress in medicine was that people went to hospitals to die, not to die, but they went to hospital and died there because there was an expectation that medicine could ameliorate, if not cure, virtually anything. And gradually, end of life, death and dying, moved from the home and from communities into hospitals and professions and institutions. And it's not just a taboo amongst society at large. This taboo is very strong amongst the medical profession as well, which was one of the things that I found frustrating, was that my own profession was afraid of initiating conversations with patients and families. I noticed that it was always easier to order another CT scan or another round of chemotherapy than it was to sit down with people and have what is commonly called the difficult conversation. And the very fact that it's called the difficult conversation, I think, is emblematic and symptomatic of what's going on. Doctors are just not having these conversations with people. One of my roles, as well as being a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the, you know, the GI tract and liver, was that I was doing a lot of what is called general medicine. And when you do general medicine, you pick up patients who have been abandoned by other services. And I was picking up people who were abandoned, let's say, by oncologists. And they were attending oncology outpatients. They had been through MDTs and all of this kind of stuff. Everything seemed to be going well. Then there's this catastrophic deterioration. They end up in hospital. They end up under whichever doctor is doing general medicine that day, me, and they die on that admission without ever having had this conversation with anyone. And I was kind of angry with all of this. I was thinking, why have they been denied this knowledge? Why have they been denied this insight? And then everything unravels at the end, as you know, down in a corridor in the back of the emergency department on a trolley with a doctor that they've never met before. And yet they believed that everything was going hunky-dory because they'd been to the outpatients and they'd completed the course of chemo. Everything was great. How could this happen? And who the hell are you? So that was a lot of my experience. And I've been particularly hard on oncology because there was, and there still is, this culture within oncology of avoiding these kind of conversations. Now, I'm not saying all oncologists are like that, but a lot of them are. And I was seeing this on a regular basis, thinking, this is terrible. Mm. And it wasn't just oncology, it was all sorts of specialty groups. So it all came as a kind of catastrophic surprise then, when there's this sudden acute deterioration culminating in death. Mm. Nobody had ever said, by the way, what you've got is going to kill you, and there's nothing we can do to reverse that. And nobody ever said that. Nobody ever asked them, well, when this happens, what is your expectation? Mm. What do you want to have done? Do you want to end up in hospital? Would you prefer maybe to be managed at home when this acute deterioration is going to happen? This conversation was just not happening. And people were dying without knowing they were dying. I was having these conversations with families at a time of crisis over a bank holiday weekend on a corridor in the emergency department. And I thought, this is terrible. Mm-hmm. Can't we do better than this?
I mean, I've heard you say elsewhere that you described it as a difficult conversation, and I believe you've gone on to describe it as the essential conversation.
Yes.
And that is a really, you know, it's a very useful shift of what the consequences of that is. Difficult makes it feel difficult. We don't want to do difficult things. Something that's essential really changes the flavour of that event. I was very, you know, when I heard that, I liked that switch around. But just to go a little bit deeper, so some of that has been created by the overextension of medicine. So medicine, and I'm just generalising and saying medicine as something, is now believing some of its own narrative about its powers. And at the same time, us, every one of us that will eventually be served by it, are coming in with expectations that are just not realistic. Is that part of the dynamic?
Yes, that is part of the dynamic. I think this golden age of medicine that I've written about changed the whole culture of medicine. You know, before that, medicine was relatively powerless and ineffective for an awful lot of things. You know, I wrote about the experience of my mother who lost her elder brother as a teenager from tuberculosis. He died at home. That's where people die then. He died at home. He was a teenager. He just died at home. I graduated in medicine just at the tail end of this golden age. I graduated in 1983. But this period of rapid technological expansion created a whole new paradigm in medicine, particularly hospital medicine. The focus was mainly biotechnological. It was focused on cure, fixing. It was focused on the biology. It was focused on the scans, the metrics. And I think we kind of lost sight of the fact that we deal with humans, that we're all going to die, and that doctors and medicine have limited powers. There was this kind of hubristic triumphalism within my own profession. Now, I think a lot of that has died off somewhat over the last decade, I would think. But certainly, when I was a young doctor, this was the overwhelming culture within medicine. There was no training whatsoever in management of dying people. There was not a single lecture on the care of the dying. Nothing. Absolutely nothing, right? I had months and years of pharmacology, anatomy, molecular biology, all of which I've forgotten, and not 5 minutes on the care of the dying. Extraordinary. Now, that has changed, but not quite enough. And this paradigm drifted out into society at large. If you read newspapers, watch television, there is this subliminal message the whole time that, wow, look at all these boffins, what they're going to do for us. I'm not downplaying science. I'm very glad to have got a COVID vaccine. I'm not downplaying that at all. But we never, ever admitted to limitations, to humility, to the fact that we're all going to die. And I felt very much at odds with my own profession in all of this. And I was also in a slightly unusual position in that I'm not a hospice doctor. I'm not a geriatrician. I'm a gastroenterologist. And the culture within gastroenterology is very much biotechnological. So I felt a bit of an outlier within my own speciality and certainly within my own profession. But when I started writing about all of this, people would contact me and say, God, you're absolutely right. Nobody wanted to say it, but a lot of people were thinking what I was thinking. So I don't think I'm alone. A lot of people were saying, no, this is all wrong. We have to change what we're doing.
You do talk about palliative care in there. And again, you apply the same kind of rigour that you have done to your own profession and discipline and, you know, the hospital and the acute sector. And one of the sort of expectations, I think, was that that would improve the general understanding of the care for the dying. We would just get better at it. And that there would then be some process, some means whereby that knowledge would disseminate out into the general medical world and there would be an uplift. And I got the impression that much like trickle down in economics, there is limitations to that process, that we can't really trust it necessarily to do that. And that palliative care has continued in a way, again, very much in the way that medicine certainly used to be, and I suspect still does, silos itself off into distinct professions and specialities. If you were to sort of say a few words about palliative care in terms of now and what should, you know, someone who works in a hospice, what should palliative care be doing to take that out, if that's the right thing?
I think palliative care is at a crossroads. I think that this idea that you've mentioned, that its attitudes would somehow trickle out into the rest of the medical profession, that hasn't occurred. And palliative care has gone its own way, but it's not been as influential throughout the rest of medicine as I think it might have been. I think that hospices in the UK particularly are in crisis financially. and existentially, in that they're not really sure anymore what they're for. And I think there is an acceptance within palliative care that they cannot continue with their current model. So are they going to be working out in the community? Should hospices be something different? Should they be more of a community resource? I mean, you may or may not know that I've been involved with this commission run by The Lancet for the past several years called The Value of Death. The Lancet Journal puts together these commissions on big questions within medicine and healthcare, and one of them was on death, or on the value of death. And I've been working with that commission for many years. And this is a global commission with people from all sorts of backgrounds, not just healthcare, but economics, philosophy, religious life, community groups, and so on. And I think the take-home message is that death and dying has become too professionalized, too institutionalized, that it needs to go back to communities and to families. I'm not saying that we need to unprofessionalize death and dying. There will always be a need for doctors and nurses and other health professionals, but it has become too much focused on buildings and hospices and on professional groups. People who are dying spend a fraction of their time dealing with professionals. They spend most of their time with their families and with their friends in their communities, who feel disempowered and incapable and lost. And paradoxically, one of the effects of palliative care as an enterprise may have been to take away from communities and families these traditional roles. Healthcare and professionals will never provide the context or the support or the ritual or the hinterland that communities and families will provide. I'm actually a fan of palliative care. I like palliative care doctors. I like talking to them. I like hanging out with them. I go to their conferences. You know, I'm the kind of the good gastroenterologist, you know, they like me. I like them too. I think they can be a little bit too solemn. You know, there is a degree of sanctimoniousness within the entire enterprise, which I have attacked before. I call it chronic niceness. They don't like me mentioning this, but I do occasionally. But I am a fan, you know, I like them. I like the fact that they think that the relief of suffering is actually the doctor's core role. I applaud this. I admire it. But I do think that the enterprise is at an existential crossroads, and I'm not quite sure which way it's going to go. So, for example, many people believe that we need to develop a discipline called nursing home medicine. We have frailty, and dementia is now the major cause of death in the UK. And there is a good argument to be made for having doctors who do what is called nursing home medicine, who would, I think, bring together an unsatisfactory, patchy network of care that is provided currently by GPs, geriatrics, palliative care, and private and public nursing homes. None of it sort of integrated. I think there's a good argument to be made for that. I mean, many palliative care doctors would say there should be no need for palliative care if they had succeeded in one of their stated missions, which was to spread their message out to the rest of medicine. If the rest of medicine had bought their message, if their educational process was the success that they wanted it to be, there would be no need for them to exist. So they're the only medical specialty who strive for their own dissolution. So they're kind of stuck as to what they're there for and what they're going to do, I think. Mm. They're not quite sure anymore. And I think the financial crisis in hospices over the last few years has exacerbated this as well.
Perfect. I mean, that literally, you've described many of my thoughts and concerns, observations, really. Yeah. What are the, again, I'm sorry I keep going on about the one book, but you have a section on philosophy. And you use Montaigne's aphorism, something like "to philosophize is to learn how to die," or something like this.
Yes.
So in it, you use a number of philosophers and writers, essentially looking at the notion, I guess, of preparedness. Is it possible to be prepared for one's death? Can you reconcile yourself to your impermanence, was the sort of thrust of that section. One of the things I was struck by again by the book, you also talk about religion. You don't really go into it, but that sort of spiritual dimension and of the dying, that something non-physical as well as totally physical is going on. And I wonder, in the last minutes we've got, because you've got an extraordinary amount of experience of death and dying out there, bearing witness to, seeing, in all its uncomfortable, difficult, messy aspects, I suspect. And you're a very learned man with a very powerful, reflective mind, as evidenced by your writing, I would suggest. Have you got any sense of whether you are prepared for your own death, or what that might look like, or what that might feel like? Or is that just you only know when you're there and God knows until then, sort of thing?
I suspect that it's the latter, that it's all very well saying, oh, yes, you know, I'm a philosopher and, you know, I'm thinking about death every day, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And in the book, when I looked at various philosophers, and I came to the conclusion that, no, that philosophers had no advantage. I did conclude, however, that doctors might have a slight advantage in that at least you have enough knowledge that when you are given a particular diagnosis of a life-limiting disease, you have some insight as to what lies ahead. Now, I wrote a piece for The Lancet, actually, based on my book called Do Doctors Die Better Than Philosophers? And I wrote, probably yes. And there's good empirical evidence that doctors at the end of life, compared to their patients, are less likely to have invasive procedures and investigations, very unlikely to have chemotherapy for metastatic cancer, PEG tubes, and so on. And I came to the conclusion that we doctors commonly recommend and carry out treatments and investigations that we wouldn't dream of having for ourselves, which is a rather uncomfortable conclusion. Do I think about death every day? No. We live in a death-denying society. And, you know, for the first time in human history, people in high-income countries like, you know, the UK and Ireland, people can expect to live into their 9th or 10th decades. Mm. So death for most of us seems very remote and very far away. And I don't believe that philosophy confers any particular advantage. I do, however, value my own professional knowledge and experience. I think it will give me a degree of insight that people who do not work in healthcare would not have. But on the other hand, I've seen several doctors at the end of life in a state of denial as bad as any of their patients.
Yeah, none of us get away with it, do we? I suppose that's the truth of it. Yeah. Seamus, once again, thank you so very, very much for coming on podcast. I wish you all the best with all of your endeavours. You certainly haven't retired, from life and all its facets. So, yeah, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to the Life and Death podcast. You can rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love you to ask us any questions or share your experience of death and dying in your review. Or let us know on social media by searching for us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospice.org.uk, where there are lots of resources to support people who are experiencing grief and bereavement. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.